From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The price of oil is skidding down from $115 a barrel this summer to $90 a few days ago. Something like war in the Middle East, big tensions with Russia, winter coming, and still oil prices down. Why is that? And what's it mean for oil producers from Russia to Iran, for American tight oil, for green, clean energy? This hour On Point, oil prices head south. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you explain the drop? American tight oil drillers, how low can oil go and keep you profitable? Solar, wind people, does cheaper oil knock you out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Everybody out there is talking about oil and oil prices. Here on CNBC and Yahoo Finance's Talking Numbers yesterday, host Brian Sullivan reported on those low oil prices.
Well, the crude oil crush simply continues. Crude oil now dipping to its lowest level in more than a year. Concerns about the health of the global economy, more oil being pumped out of America and elsewhere. Question is, how low can it go? Let's talk numbers.
The crude oil crush. We start today with Nicole Friedman, energy markets reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nicole, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So 115 in June, 90 in one of the first days of October. Where's oil now, Nicole?
Yeah, so global prices are at about $90 and U.S. prices about $87. So both of them are more than $20 down from where they were in June.
Can you just explain global and U.S.? You know, we know oil is fungible. It can be sent anywhere, anytime. So are there always different prices in different parts of the world? What's the difference?
There are. You know, oil is fungible, but actually most crude oil cannot be exported from the U.S. And so that's one of the reasons for the different prices, that U.S. oil pretty much has to be processed and turned into products in the U.S. And because there's so much production right now in the U.S. from the tight oil boom, those prices tend to be a little bit lower than global prices.
These current prices we're reading here at a 17-month low, but oil prices have been pretty high for quite a while. How does this current range, around 90, look historically?
Yeah, it's definitely still high historically. We've seen oil prices even, you know, in the past decade below 40 at $10. And so we're still high, but compared to where we've been in the last 3 or 4 years, this is definitely a notable low. And even compared to where we were at the beginning of the summer when prices really spiked on fears about violence in Iraq. And it's since then, a lot of these geopolitical hotspots haven't actually resulted in any interruption of oil supplies. And so prices have really markedly tumbled in the last 4 months.
There's so much talk about this, in the energy press and the financial press. Why are people so focused on this skid, this drop, Nicole?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons is that the big focus is on the idea that we maybe have an oversupply of oil, which I think is something that people had never expected to happen, especially in 2008 when prices spiked to nearly $150 and there was all this talk about peak oil and running out of oil. And now with all this new production in the U.S., there's actually more oil at the moment than can be absorbed by demand.
Will OPEC step in and take measures, I guess, tighten their output, reduce their output to try and drive it back up? When do they next meet? What's the speculation there?
Yeah, that's the big question. And a lot of people are really looking to OPEC and watching for any signals of what the group will do. They next meet in late November. So it's still a while from now. And some individual countries have put out signals. The Secretary General of OPEC said in September that he thinks they will cut their collective output goal at the next meeting. But it's still unclear whether it's really Saudi Arabia is the swing producer that has the most power here and whether Saudi Arabia wants to cut or is willing to withstand slightly lower prices and maybe kind of ride this out for a while longer.
What's Saudi Arabia fighting for there? Is it fighting against other producers, even now the U.S.? We've heard about the U.S. challenging Saudi Arabia for oil production. Or is it fighting perhaps a more slow but inexorable, maybe, wave of clean energy?
It's hard to say. I think the Saudis are definitely fighting for market share. That's the big speculation right now, that particularly in Asia, they've recently cut their prices. And so even in a lower price environment, the Saudis are still trying to keep their buyers committed to buying Saudi oil. And the U.S. and Russia have are kind of neck to neck with Saudi Arabia in terms of oil production, and the U.S. is expected to become the largest oil producer within even a year or two. And so Saudi Arabia could be kind of willing to let prices go a little bit lower to make sure that it maintains its share of the global market.
So when we see the headlines that say price war, usually that means competing to be lowest. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia just came out with its November prices, and it did cut its selling prices to some of the lowest levels in years. And so that's really sparked speculation about a price war and that it's trying to compete for buyers globally. But there's also some thought that by the time November rolls around, prices get even lower, there will be a move by OPEC to cut. And so there's still not a clear consensus on what the group will do.
The Saudis just sort of poke the sand and the oil comes out, I guess. In the U.S., the big boom has come in hydraulic fracturing, fracking. It's a lot more cost and labor intensive. How low can oil prices go and still make fracking profitable in this country?
Yeah, that's another big question. One thing is that fracking technologies have gotten a lot more efficient in the last couple of years. And so the price of producing a barrel of oil in, say, North Dakota or Texas, some of these big fracking locations, the price has gone down. And so what maybe was an $80 break-even cost a couple of years ago might be as low as $60 now. And so right now, prices are still at $87. People say that's high enough that we won't see any shut-ins of wells or a pullback in new investment. But some analysts say if prices fall below 80 for even a couple of weeks, we could see capital expenditure plans changed and companies basically pulling back on drilling new wells and waiting for prices to go back up.
And Nicole, what about clean energy producers, solar and wind? We've long been told that the more expensive oil is, the more room they have to develop their products at the higher cost structure that they have had historically. If it goes down, does it start to crimp their style?
It definitely might. I mean, in the transportation fuel market, we're seeing gasoline, the national average for gasoline prices is about $3.25 a gallon, which is 50 cents lower than we saw earlier in the summer. And so that's a big boon to drivers and consumers, and that could be an incentive not to invest in, say, natural gas driving cars or electric vehicles.
Nicole Friedman with The Wall Street Journal, it's great to talk with you. Thanks so much for giving us a debrief right here.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Friedman, energy markets reporter for The Wall Street Journal. People looked at the Middle East. They looked at all the tension with Russia. They looked at the fighting going on with the self-declared Islamic State and said, whoa, this could mean high oil prices, disruption. That fighting still goes on. Here's BBC correspondent Paul Adams reporting just yesterday on the fierce fighting in Kobani between ISIS and Kurdish fighters as U.S.-led coalition airstrikes continue.
The fighting was absolutely raging on the other side. I don't know how much you can see on this line of the scene in Kobani this morning and early this afternoon. But parts of the city are obscured by black smoke. There are huge explosions from time to time. And the sheer volume of gunfire was just terrifying. It seemed as if dozens and dozens of weapons were firing at once.
We're looking in this hour at world oil prices way down in spite of all that tension and outright conflict in the Middle East. With us right now from New York, Michael Levy, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment, Director of the Center for Geoeconomic Studies, Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Power Surge and By All Means Necessary, How China's Resource Quest is Changing the World. Michael Levy, thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Our screens and microphones and speakers are full of news out of the Middle East, and it's all about conflict. We recall historically when wars and conflict crank up there, oil prices crank up with them. Why the other way this time, Michael?
I think Nicole hit the nail on the head. There's more supply right now than there is demand to absorb it. So while events in the Middle East, I'm sure, have oil prices higher than they otherwise would be, there are bigger forces at work. And there are two big forces in particular. We've had these surprising gains in U.S. oil production in recent years that the global market still hasn't fully adjusted to. And we've seen in recent weeks really consistently weak news on global economic growth. And weak news on global economic growth means lower than expected oil consumption. You put those two pieces together with a market that doesn't have that many shock absorbers, and you can see prices fall rapidly for a fairly sustained period of time.
We're down to around 90 now, have been at 90 this month in the U.S. benchmark. How low do you think oil prices could go, Michael?
Who knows? What I know for certain is that this last 3 years of fairly stable oil prices has lulled a lot of people, or had lulled a lot of people, into a false sense of security. There was a belief emerging that we would see oil prices stable forever, that there, we were in a new world where maybe U.S. supply buffered the market and kept things stable. I think we could see prices fall a lot, considerably below the sort of long-term cost of bringing new production on the market. In the long run, it probably costs $80 or $90 to bring enough new production on the market to meet global demand. But in the short run, people will keep their projects running. They will often keep investing. They will certainly keep operating, even if prices fall a lot. And so that allows things to get out of whack for a long time. You saw that in 2008. Prices went from $150 almost a barrel to $30 or $40 before spiking back up again within a year or two.
Falling prices mean trouble for some countries. Which ones in particular?
Iran is high up on the list, and so is Russia. You might also think about a country like Venezuela. What do all of those have in common? They have large demands on their budgets. Their budgets are dependent in a significant way on oil revenues, and that means that they don't have a lot of room for error.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about world oil prices way down, why that is, what it means for geopolitics, what it means for the push to get away from fossil fuels, and for that matter, for fracking, for hydraulic fracturing in this country going after tight oil that has made America suddenly a big oil producer. People thought, well, conflict would drive it up, and of course there's been plenty of that. Here's the sound of a U.S. Tomahawk missile headed into Syria. And impacts all over the world when oil prices go down. On Reuters Monday, here's Mike Ingram of BGC Partners talking about the effect of low oil prices on the Russian economy.
The ruble is going to remain weak. It's certainly not helped by dollar strength. It's certainly not helped by the fact that oil prices continue to slump. And of course, that is the major earner for the Russian budget. They need to see prices of $110 to $115 a barrel just to balance the books.
Mike Levy is with us from New York, author of The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future. He's at the Council on Foreign Relations, follows all the angles on energy. So, Michael, begin to take us into this. Here we are over the summer. We see tensions ratcheting up in the Middle East. Oil prices go up. Take us to when and why they started to turn the other way. What was driving that?
If you look at the way oil prices have evolved over the last few months, you hit a high in late June, and it's basically fallen consistently since then. There have been rallies here and there of a dollar or two, but it's been mostly a continuous fall. I think what's happened since then is a gradually increasing recognition that global demand is not there to support current levels of supply. That's number one. And number two, particularly in recent weeks, there's been emerging information that suggests that oil production in some OPEC countries, and particularly Saudi Arabia, is higher than a lot of people suppose. It's important to remember that while in the United States, you get daily data, weekly data, monthly data, high quality data. Saudi Arabia, you don't. And so there can be sudden surprises that prompt people to reevaluate their view of markets. And that seems to be what's happened recently.
Let's talk about supply and new areas of supply that may be part of the factor. It will come to the U.S., but people are looking at Iraq more coming on stream despite the trouble there. At Libya, what about those two?
So Iraq has been one of the big hopes in the global oil market, at least for people who want to see prices lower. And if you look at projections from the last few years, they anticipate large gains in Iraqi supply. I think that still what's happening in Iraq is weighing on oil prices. It is holding them up, I think, above what they actually would be otherwise. People are skeptical that Iraq can generate the investment and the production that a lot of these forecasters anticipated, given the security environment there. In Libya, what you had is you've had a lot of labor unrest that was roiling the country in the wake of the civil war that was holding production down. And then suddenly, in recent months, some of that seems to have reversed and production has gone up. And so you get these surprising changes. Now, what's striking is that you've had similar surprises over the last few years, but they've been offset by surprising shifts elsewhere. And we've had essentially an extraordinary sequence. that's kept prices relatively stable. So what's happening now is a bit more normal. We have a series of flukes that don't magically offset each other.
What about the threat of war or the fact of war there? I mean, people are calling it war right now with the Islamic State. You got a big coalition. They're looking to take over Iraq. They made a lot of progress on that over the summer, slowed down a little bit lately, maybe, but they haven't really gone into retreat. Does this low oil price mean that energy people don't believe that we're headed into region-wide turmoil in the Middle East oil patch?
I think that's a significant part of it. And it's not just energy people. If you look at broader global equities markets, there seems to be a sense of complacency about geopolitical risk. There's a focus on things like interest rates and Federal Reserve policy, central bank policy, rather than on fundamentals, whether corporate or geopolitical. So I think that's part of it. Part of it is there tends to be an assumption that when an organization like ISIS threatens oil production, they actually want to take it over in order to sell it themselves. So that's a problem from a security standpoint if they have these revenues. But if they're going to take over production then sell it themselves, it's not a problem for the global price of oil.
And then let's look at U.S. production, the U.S. oil boom, as it's called all over the place. I mean, I'm reading headlines here talking about world on the brink of oil war. Here's another one. Oil prices, a new era of abundance seen dawning. How big is the U.S. factor, U.S. hydraulic fracturing, fracking, and all the rest in this new, bigger supply?
So headline writers have their own set of incentives.
Of course.
But that said, look, the gains in U.S. production are not only large, they're very surprising. And surprise matters a lot in the oil market because the oil market is slow to adjust normally. So we've got gain equivalent to roughly 5% of global oil production in the last several years. That's enormous in the global oil market context. And more than that, there's widespread anticipation that this will continue. But it's important to keep in mind that this abundance story is often overdone. The United States remains a large oil importer. Oil prices remain at what would be historically high levels. We have a five-year average oil price, the average price in the last 5 years, that has passed $100 a barrel for the first time ever. This is not a world that is entirely about abundance of oil.
So when we talk about who gets hit here, we'll come back to what falling prices mean for fracking. But what about Russia? You're looking at their budget. They must make certain assumptions about what the price of oil will be going forward. I'm reading here a report that the Russian finance minister said, I think this week, that their big plan for a multi-billion dollar upgrade to Russia's armed forces, they can't afford it anymore because of this drop in oil price.
Right. So Russia has to make choices. This is not a matter of Russia going bankrupt, but they have to cut back on discretionary expenses, and some of their defense expenditures are discretionary. You get similar case in places like Iran and in Venezuela. There are others like Saudi Arabia that have an enormous amount of money in the bank and so can ride out the challenges. By the way, you also have large consuming countries in areas that are geopolitically important that are affected by this. Countries like Jordan and Egypt, whose budgets are enormously strained by subsidies to energy prices, actually get some relief from this development, and that matters. Jordan, for example, is struggling to deal with refugees from what's happening in Iraq and Syria.
Politically,
so this
helpful.
Is all very helpful.
Then take us to the U.S., and let's get into the regions that have been booming on the energy front, some on natural gas, some on straight oil, but it brought out of the ground in new ways. Where's the boom been the greatest, and what does the drop-off in oil prices mean in Texas, in the Dakotas? You tell us.
When it comes to oil, the big hot spots have been, like you said, Texas and North Dakota. There's also been some natural gas production elsewhere that's supported by oil prices. Some of the gas that's produced, we call it wet gas, comes out of the ground together with liquids that are similar to oil and fetch a higher price, and so that keeps that going. Right now, prices don't seem to be threatening the investment that's happening and the pace of production. I think where you're more likely to see pressure, at least at first, is in expansion into new areas. When developers move into new regions, they're taking higher risks. They need to innovate and understand the geology. All those things require a higher price. And so some of that might be put on hold as prices fall. Now, a lot of the people in those areas won't even know that they've temporarily at least missed out on the boom. So it's not so much of a collapse as perhaps a slowdown in the expansion.
Well, I'm looking here at a report out of North Dakota. Drillers there talking about a sustained pullback if global prices would go and stay below $80 a barrel. What do you say?
I think we'll see. the costs of investing involve things like renting rigs. The rigs are already out there, so it's not like people are just going to leave them doing nothing. You often see cost compression in industry when prices fall. We've seen that historically. People suddenly find new incentives to cut costs. But the reality is no one really knows, and this will be something that we understand in real time.
Michael Levy is author of The Power Surge. Michael Levy, stand by in New York. Lots of callers for you. Brian in Vermont, Jeffersonville. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
In my opinion, I mean, I'm seeing a couple things going on here, one of which is the price of oil and oil-based energy. As it goes higher, it makes the alternative energies like solar and wind more economically feasible. And as those little jumps happen and more people get into those green energy areas, they see that it works.
But what about when it goes the other way, Brian? Now oil's going lower. Does that make it harder for alternative energy to get up on the rails?
Well, a cynical person might say that those prices are being manipulated. I don't know if that's the answer or not. But obviously, over the years, we've seen some interesting fluctuations in the prices of oil. Sometimes they're based on reality. Sometimes they're based on, well, we don't really even know.
Yeah. Brian, let us pick it up. Michael Levy, is there another kind of price war underway here? Yes, it may be Saudis looking for market share. But it's not hard to find speculation if you look around these days that this is about, you know, trying to strangle alternative energy in the cradle by driving oil lower, making it more competitive again.
I think there's certainly price competition, but the people producing oil in North Dakota and Texas aren't doing it to strangle alternative energy. They're doing it because they can make a lot of money. It's important, though, to have one distinction here. Oil doesn't compete with solar and wind. We don't use oil to produce electricity. We don't use solar and wind to drive our cars. So falling oil prices don't create a hit on solar and wind. Only in Teslas, but there the key link is getting cheap, abundant electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. Where the competition does exist, though, is with natural gas and with coal. And so falling natural gas prices does create some pressure on solar and wind. Right now, the biggest factors determining the future of solar and wind are government support and technological progress. And the technological progress in innovation in business and finance has been pretty extraordinary.
Let's go to Laverne in Omaha, Nebraska. Laverne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. In 2003, Amory Lovin and Rocky Mountain Institute produced a report called Linear Oil Endgame. And he said at $15 a barrel, it was very profitable to pursue efficiency. So he suggested $180 billion in radical efficiency over 10 years, and you're oil-free in 25, and that's because of you having the cars get traded in every 15 years. And so for every dollar you spend on efficiency, you displace $3 to $5 of future energy costs. For every dollar you spend on efficiency, you create $7 to $12 of economic activity. And for every time the oil prices go down, that saves me money here at my electric company, or, you know, electricity and my transportation fuel. So that frees up billions of dollars within the economy. So each individual now has an extra $5 or $10 in their pocket that they can spend on something other than oil, such as a vacation or a beer or dinner or a boat.
Of course, there's oil in a lot of those other things, but do you think it slows down the movement to alternative energy, Laverne, or not?
I think the lowering of price does not, because it's truly still profitable at $15 a barrel to pursue efficiency. It's just cheaper to not use energy than it is to use energy.
Laverne, I appreciate your call from Omaha. Michael, stand by in New York. Nathaniel Green joins us from New York as well. He's Director of Renewable Energy Policy in the Energy and Transportation Program at the National Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. Nathaniel, thanks for joining us today.
Tom, thanks for having me.
You hear our Omaha caller there saying, hey, it can go all the way to $15 a barrel and there's no bite on alternative energy development. What do you say, Nathaniel?
Well, I think the caller was making a really important point about energy efficiency and how energy efficiency is always the lowest cost, best solution. Ultimately, we do need some form of energy to drive our cars and heat and light our homes. And I think Mike made the point right on that, you know, we don't use oil to generate electricity right now, and we don't use very much electricity to drive our cars or our buses. So these markets are for now decoupled. But I do think, and the callers are sort of emphasizing this, that politically and in the popular mindset, the volatility, the risk, the environmental pollution caused by our addiction to oil very much is part of why we want to get off of fossil fuels more broadly. It's why we still have policies that really are encouraging innovation and adoption of wind power and solar power, these technologies where the price, you know, the price of the wind, the price of the sun is free. It's always going to be free. It's always going to be pollution free. So it gets us out of this this sort of very volatile, very risky fossil fuel landscape.
So connections here, but not always a direct seesaw. Stand by, Nathaniel. Jack in Corbin, Kentucky. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
And my question is, you know, for the common man, you know, I hear about prices of oil dropping. What does that do for us at the gas pumps? And secondly, if we're going through this anyway, and they look a little bit ahead and say something for a stimulus for the common person,
yeah,
you know, you're killing two birds with one stone, I think.
It might feel good in a hurry if it goes that way. Appreciate your call, Jack. Michael Levy, how about it? We heard from Nicole at the top of the hour. Gasoline prices down to $3.25 a gallon. Of course, they're different all over, but sort of an average, they're down 50 cents, which is a lot. What about gasoline prices for drivers and the potential for an economic stimulus in the oil price fall?
I think that's the right way to think about it. When you have a $20 decline in oil prices, you should have roughly a 50 cent decline in the price of a gallon of gasoline. And that goes into people's pockets. They spend it. It's a stimulus to the economy, just like a tax cut might be. But over the long run, I think Nathaniel makes a really important point. There are two ways to save money on your gasoline bill. One is to have lower gasoline prices, and that's helpful, and that matters. But the other is to use less gasoline for every mile that you drive. And that means shifting to more efficient vehicles and to, as part of that, alternative vehicles. I think that's an extraordinarily important piece of this equation. The less gasoline we use for every mile we drive, the less important this volatility in oil prices will be.
But consumers respond very quickly. I'm reading here that just last month in September, those more efficient vehicles already saw their sales numbers decline and gas guzzler or something closer to it rose, apparently because gas prices are cheaper.
I mean, that's absolutely right. You've seen, I think, reports out in the last day or two of increasing purchases of SUVs and a forecast over the next year of less adoption of efficient vehicles than we've expected in the past couple of years. And that's part of why this can be driven in part by prices, but you need to have a regulatory component to it. So you need things like fuel economy standards that have been put out there for cars and trucks that push people into more efficient vehicles. You saw in the 1980s when oil prices were extraordinarily low, people bought very inefficient cars, and that's come back to bite us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about world oil prices way down, looking at why that is and what it means for geopolitics, for fossil fuel consumption, for alternative energy, maybe for the U.S., maybe for the global economy. Nathaniel Green is with us from the NRDC. He follows renewable energy policy there. Michael Levy is with us, author of The Power Surge. He's at the Council on Foreign Relations. Nathaniel, Michael, lots of response online. Brian Jones tells us that gas is $2.92 a gallon in Austin right now. Paul writes in, says, not low enough. Pat says, $2.88 at Kroger for regular. Americans are paying attention here. Let's hear from them. Amy in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Amy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just had two comments. I wanted to say that, first of all, I think this is a very positive thing. There's always somewhat heated debate in the U.S. when we talk about drilling for more oil. But I think this would be a very different conversation if we hadn't had the foresight to do that right now with what's going on in the world. We'd probably be talking about very high prices. And secondly, I know there's an environmental impact, but when you look at shipping oil across giant oceans, it seems like that should have an impact as well. So it seems better to go ahead and drill here at home rather than put that cost or environmental cost on shipping it across oceans.
Amy, let us pick it up. Michael Levy, we remember Drill Baby Drill. Now here we are. What's the connection? Amy says, bravo.
If we hadn't had these big gains in U.S. production, odds are very high that oil prices would be substantially higher right now, perhaps in the range of $150 a barrel. So that's certainly a big piece of the equation. I think over the longer run, it's tougher to push oil prices down a lot using U.S. production. Other producers around the world adjust their own output to offset that to a substantial degree. But certainly right now, and the caller is right, this has been a boon to the U.S. economy, both from the direct impact, people getting jobs working in this business, but also in the indirect impact through what it's done for oil prices.
Nathaniel, you're there at the National Resources Defense Council, renewable energy man. How do you feel about the way all that has worked out, fracking, the U.S. fossil fuel surge?
Well, I think Mike makes exactly the right point, which is that in the long run, our drilling here at home isn't going to change the volatility, isn't going to change the international security risks associated with oil, and it's not going to change the environmental pollution that, you know, threatens the air we breathe, the water we drink, the future of our children.
But it has changed the price, Michael says.
Yeah, and you know, we all like low prices, so I don't have any argument with that. Fortunately, I think Mike also made the point that, you know, we're still in a period of historically very high oil prices, and the volatility and risk associated with oil, coupled with that high, you know, long-term high price, really has meant that we've driven incredible innovation in the alternatives, driven down the cost of electric vehicles. Even though it's not directly associated, we've also driven down the cost of wind and solar power. And so, the fastest sectors of growing sectors of our economy through the recession was the clean energy sector. This is the fastest growing sector of the energy economy worldwide. We can compete in that as a country. In terms of long-term economic growth in our country, this is where it's at. People are getting jobs here. It helps our not just our economy, but our environment. So I'm not worried about a short-term dip in oil prices changing people's perception and the reality of where we want to go in the future.
Pamela in Concord, Massachusetts. Pamela, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for talking to me. Every time the price of gas goes down here, I go, oh, no, because I realize that the cost of energy, the cost of our fuel, our gas and all, isn't connected to its real price. Because what it's doing to the world with global warming, the economic impact's the worst thing. We need, as long as the cost of gasoline isn't included in its price, we can't have a good market. We can't have an efficient market.
And you mean the full environmental cost. So what would you do here, Pamela?
Put a revenue-neutral carbon tax on the oil producers and rebate it to the people to keep it from destroying the poor people's economy.
Right. So put some cash back in their pocket even as you tax it with a rebate. Michael Levy, is this it? Is this the time? People have talked a lot about a carbon tax. When oil prices are down, is this the time? I mean, the politics are intense, but would this be the time to do that, Michael?
I was going to say, I think I hear applause from distant economics departments and fear in every politician's office. Look.
But you know what Pamela's talking about. We see these
parts
per million of carbon going up and up, and we see what's happening with climate change.
So, look, I will stand at the front of the parade to call for a stronger price on carbon. And I think that if we used the revenue from that to reduce other taxes, we could have a win-win outcome for the economy and for the environment. But the reality is that that's not on the political agenda, at least in the near-term horizon. And so we need to figure out how to deal with those carbon impacts in ways that we actually have available. And so we've seen fuel economy standards for cars and trucks. We've seen in the works EPA rules, Environmental Protection Agency rules for existing coal-fired power plants, very large source of greenhouse gas emissions. We can't wait for the perfect and not take advantage of the opportunities we have to do other things that are still cost-effective opportunities to reduce our emissions.
Austin, Texas, Mark is calling. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment on the connection between oil prices and the growth of wind and solar that's already been made, but add a little bit to it. Essentially, as your speakers have said, there's really very, very weak connection because we have two relatively separate energy economies. We have a transportation sector, which, of course, is oil, and we have an electricity sector, and which is natural gas, nuclear, coal, and increasingly wind and solar. And the only connection that we're going to see, which is very, very small right now but growing, is electric cars, of course, which are transportation, but they use electricity, some of which will come from wind and solar. So the main point I'm making is that price of oil is really very, very unconnected to the growth of wind and solar.
Yeah.
Wind and solar is going to happen because of technological improvements, which we've seen, especially in the last few years in solar, partially government policies, but really I think the big factor that hasn't been mentioned yet is interest rates, real cost of money. Very low interest rates make it possible to invest profitably in wind and solar, which are extremely sensitive to the cost of money.
Mark, it's a great point. I mean, even if oil prices are coming down, it's still been a good period, and so have alternative energy prices and costs come way down. Solar, we hear a lot about. Wind, I'm not so sure. Nathaniel, weigh in here, because, of course, Mark's right. You've got more oil in transportation, more alternative energy, and other kinds of energy use. But we've got people online, Stephen, saying here, high oil prices are great for alternative energy, saying solar and wind stocks follow the oil markets in parallel. I mean, even though there's different channels for use, they seem to be somehow connected, Nathaniel, in the way that investment goes beyond even the interest rate question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sort of popular connection in the energy market between oil prices and fossil fuel, the fossil fuel markets more broadly, as opposed to the alternatives. But, you know, the reality of the actual prices, they don't swing that tightly together, which is actually part of why electric vehicles are such an attractive option right now, right? Because you've got this relatively stable electric price through your utility, and that makes driving an electric vehicle very cost effective. So I think there's a political connection as well, and Mike started to touch on some of the things that we do see happening. And the sort of stable and growing economy is key for politicians feeling that they can do some of this. We actually did set a greenhouse gas standard for vehicles, and that has, you know, really driven the biggest increase in vehicle efficiency that we've seen in the past 30 years, really. I think the downturn in the economy, millennials getting out of the car culture a little bit, more folks moving into the city, has also really driven a drop in how much we drive as a country. So, you know, there are connections here between the economy, how we think about and consume oil, and then how we think about the alternatives. But it's not a tight economic connection.
Yeah, not one-to-one. Michael in Hoover, Alabama. Michael, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm a truck driver. I drive an 18-wheeler across the country.
Yeah.
I've been driving for the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And companies, so many trucking companies in America, and there's a lot of them, they spend billions of dollars each year on diesel fuel. And since I've been in this industry, I've noticed some of the companies are trying to go with propane, and they're actually running propane. And would you know of any input on that? Have you heard or researched any of that? Because
yeah,
it's kind of new to me, but I've heard from drivers, they're saying it works wonderful and it's great on the environment.
Michael, tell us, can you drive an 18-wheeler on propane, even a big rig like that?
Yes, sir.
I have to admit.
Talking to Michael, our caller in Hoover there, our truck driver.
We've got a lot of Michaels here.
Michael in Alabama, is it an 18-wheeler you're talking about, sir?
Yes, that's correct. I'm talking about an 18-wheeler. I drive a commercial vehicle, and I've been driving for 7 years, and I've been told from other drivers and actually talked to one down in Louisiana, and his truck was operated by a propane, and there's something new. They have fuel pumps set up with propane, and it's supposed to be, their engine idle is real quiet. It's real economical and real efficient for the, I guess, for the, you know, environmental protection for the environment.
That sounds great and nicer to be around than diesel, no question about that. Michael in Hoover, Alabama, thanks for your call. Michael Levy, what about that movement in the big trucking industry? When oil prices go down, does it put the brakes on a move maybe toward cleaner fuel there?
Well, the big question in the long-distance trucking market is how much natural gas will penetrate. In particular, there's been a lot of interest around liquefied natural gas for long-distance trucking. You have a concentrated industry, so you can imagine building out both the trucks and the fueling infrastructure at the same time using the same companies. And so certainly, with oil prices falling, you have a larger barrier to these sorts of substitutions. But the reality is that when big companies make these sorts of shifts, first, they're hedging out some of that price exposure. So they're not necessarily so sensitive to price moves on a span of weeks or even months. But also, there are other barriers at work. And I think if we look at, if we take a step back and look broadly at this, this recognition that oil prices are far higher than natural gas prices has still not penetrated through the entire industry. And so that force, that continuing recognition that there's this big disconnect, I think is much more powerful than a $10 or $20 shift in oil prices.
Trucker Mike in Alabama, I appreciate your call. Yet another Mike, Hartford, Connecticut. Mike in Hartford, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to remind your listeners that in a market economy, best cure for high prices is high prices. And my second point was that in the late 80s and early 90s, because the Saudis were willing to pump a lot of oil, basically that caused the Russian ruble to collapse. The bonds, they defaulted on their bonds, and long-term capital went belly up. And of course, Russia went into default. Those are my only points.
They're good ones. I appreciate your call, Michael Levy. I mean, the Russian government, 3-year budget has been set, I'm reading here, with the expectation of $100 a barrel oil. I've even seen speculation that Russia might have to cool its jets on the Ukraine front if oil stays low or goes lower. How direct an impact might we see there?
Well, I think you need to look at the full Russian budget, and I assume that most of that budget is deployed domestically. And so the question that Russian leaders will be asking is how much can you cut back on that? And how much do you cut back on military expenditures? I think your caller points at a really important dynamic on both sides of the equation. He talked about the plunge in prices in the 1980s and how that put pressure on the Soviet Union. What he left out was that that pressure resulted in part from increased military expenditures that the Soviet Union had incurred during periods of extraordinarily high oil prices, late 70s, early 80s, following the Iranian Revolution. So the parallels may go even further than what he lays out.
One more caller here, Dayton, Ohio. Kent is calling. Kent, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question actually does follow on from the previous caller. Is there something about an $80 floor for oil? I believe the Saudis now have their domestic economy is supported by oil prices, and I think it costs them about $80 a barrel now. Our drillers will stop drilling at $80 a barrel. And the other question involves, at what point do the oil wells in North Dakota stop flaring off the natural gas and start capturing it?
I don't know if I can get all that in the remaining minutes that we have here, Kent, but I'll try. On Saudi Arabia, Michael, what does it take to get Saudi Arabia to take significant measures? I guess in this case, that would mean cutting back on production to try and nudge prices up. Where's their tender part with response to that?
So here's the problem. If you cut production to keep prices high because you have budgetary demands, you're suddenly selling less oil at a higher price. And that doesn't necessarily solve your budget problem.
Right.
And so this is the sort of needle that the Saudis are thinking about threading, but that can't necessarily be threaded. Again, I'll say it's important in the Saudi context to remember they have a lot of money in the bank. They've run deficits for decades in the past. They, among pretty much everyone, can be patient and wait things out. And by the way, a slightly lower oil price might be looked on favorably by some in Saudi Arabia because it hurts Iran. And Saudi Arabia is in a very tough geopolitical battle with Iran.
So this takes a lot of sophistication to look all the way through this lens. Nathaniel Green, you must see that as well. I mean, yes, it hurts Saudi Arabia, but if it hurts Iran more, we say that the conflict in the Middle East has not kept prices high, but maybe there's a reason Saudis might want them low, Nathaniel.
I think looking globally, I think what we're seeing is a real, increasing global recognition that this market is volatile, especially for Western countries. It's a very hostile market, so we need to get out of it. And I think that's why small changes in the price are not going to change policy and the efforts to improve our efficiency and the alternatives.
There's the view from the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, and Nathaniel Green. Nathaniel, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Michael Levy, author of The Power Surge and By All Means Necessary from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Michael, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you, Tom.
And listeners, for all your calls, just terrific. Always great to hear from you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.